Ludwig van Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, opus 125, is arguably the most recognizable piece of music in history. It may also be the most influential and important composition ever, a cornerstone of Western music as we know it. That's why Harvey Sachs says we must understand the politics surrounding it. Sachs is the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824.
Well, actually, what's particularly interesting about the creation of the Ninth Symphony is that it was composed at a time and in the very place in which Metternich, the Austrian chancellor, was perfecting the first modern police state. This was in the wake of the French Revolution, which had failed, at least in the short run, and the Napoleonic Wars, and all of the old regime people were coming back into power, or else those who had stayed in power were intent on maintaining it in the firmest possible way. And so it was an era of political repression, and yet here comes this amazing work that is a hymn to human brotherhood and joy, and by extension also to peace.
There's the famous change to the dedication of the Third Symphony, the Eroica, when Napoleon declared himself emperor. Beethoven, well, he believed in the existence of great men, but not in their right to be tyrants, right?
In fact, when he wrote that, he was convinced that Napoleon, and this, of course, was Napoleon's propaganda, that Napoleon was leading the French to bring the French Revolution to all of Europe. Then when Napoleon in 1804 had himself crowned emperor, Beethoven said basically, well, you know, he's just like all the rest of them. He wants power for himself. And so he destroyed the dedication to Bonaparte on the title page of the Eroica Symphony. He crossed it out and wrote, "To the memory of a great man."
What's interesting in some ways is the implication of that. He was someone who would have been interested in a great, benevolent man in charge.
You know, he believed that it was the responsibility of a great leader to make life tolerable and, if possible, good for all of the citizens of any given country.
Which is why, I guess, we so easily believe now that he was a supporter of the rights of man. The idea of the French Revolution would have appealed to him if they could have been more reasonable.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. He definitely believed that, well, as the text, Schiller's text of the finale of the Ninth Symphony says, that all men will become brothers. That was the goal of humanity. And that, you know, there would be joy, there would be love. Someday there would be this wonderful new humanity. And it tells us that this is what we should be aiming for. And Beethoven felt very, very strongly about that.
Thank you.
was thinking about the composition of the Ninth. It's one thing in an opera to put forth your political views. I suppose there must have been some opposition even to that. But no one had up to this point written a symphony, anything like the Ninth. And it was something that changed in Beethoven, that made him want to add the Ode to Joy to a work to make it clearer what he was attempting to accomplish, don't you think?
Actually, the Ode to Joy by Friedrich von Schiller was a poem that Beethoven had had it in mind to set since he was in his early 20s. And it's generally believed by musicologists that it was actually after he had begun working on his Ninth Symphony. Of course, he didn't know that the Ninth Symphony would be his last, but it was while he was working on it, sketching out the other movements, that it suddenly occurred to him that this was the right place, finally, to make use of that text, which, by the way, he does not use in its integrity. He took excerpts from the poem and rearranged them in ways that suited his musical goals. So what he's doing in the Ninth Symphony is proceeding from the catastrophic first movement to the combative scherzo, the second movement, to the sublime third movement, and then culminating with this expression of joy and brotherhood for humanity. What happens, especially what happens in this finale, the movement that makes use of the text, that has sung voices, the very beginning of the movement, there is a dissonant, catastrophic outburst from the full orchestra, and that's followed by a recitative in which we hear the themes of the first three movements being sort of rejected by the cellos and basses. In other words, he reproposes these old themes from the first three movements and says essentially, no, he has the orchestra say, no, we don't want to hear these anymore. We don't want to hear the catastrophe of the first movement. We don't want to hear the fighting in the second movement. We don't want to hear the acceptance and the sublimity of the third movement. We've heard all of that. We want something new and different. And then the voice of the bass baritone soloist enters and says, actually in words that Beethoven wrote that don't come from the Schiller text, the bass says, oh friends, no more these sounds. Let's have something more pleasant and more joyful. And then the orchestra and chorus enter with the full weight of the famous Ode to Joy theme.
It also makes you then wonder what the reaction of the world was to the Ninth, because he was being more explicit about what he wanted the Ninth to mean to listeners. He was, by the use of words, dictating a little more clearly to those of us who don't speak music exactly what he was after. And he must have also thought about who was listening, not just the musical world, but also the political world who would hear this, and for that matter, the public at large.
Yes. By the way, you know, Beethoven also taught. He taught composition and he taught piano at various stages in his career to earn money. He taught wealthy patrons. And his most important patron was the Archduke Rudolf, who was the brother, one of the many brothers, of the Austrian Emperor. And when the Archduke was, when it was announced that he was going to be appointed, installed as an archbishop in one of the Austrian provinces, Beethoven wrote him, of course, a very nice letter congratulating him. But he adds, by the way, essentially, he says, monarchs have not in the past been known as benefactors of humanity. And he urges the Archduke to go on and do good works and also, of course, to continue with his musical studies. Beethoven, you know, in the repressive atmosphere of Vienna in the 1820s, if Beethoven hadn't been A, so famous, and B, so notoriously eccentric, he could have been jailed for making a statement like that. But I'm sure the Archduke said to his secretary, you know, well, there he is, our friend Beethoven, you know, just filed the letter away, which is why we still have it today. He was interested in influencing people like the Archduke, who, of course, was a very important person in the Austrian administration. On the other hand, I don't think he really held out high hopes for his own times. I think he was aiming, in fact, I think he was the first of the important composers who really trained his big artillery at the future. He was writing for future generations, for us, and for people who have come before us and will come after us, whereas his predecessors, generally speaking, were writing for certain specific occasions, and they didn't really think that much of their music was going to survive for a long, long time.
Harvey Sachs is the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824.